I wasn't so much ashamed as just saddened and protective. It was my family and it was our business, and I didn't want people knowing about any of the dents in our familial unit because my family's bond, in addition to our large size, was always an inexplicable source of pride for me. My younger siblings and I never really discussed it either. We felt the void of our father's absence and harbored an unspoken resentment against my mother for not trying hard enough to stay with him. Or at least I did. I was aware that my mother was also going through menopause at the time of the divorce, but at 17, I didn't fully comprehend the extra layer it added to her emotional state. I remember her crying a lot, and I remember her attributing her crying to the hormonal issues she had warned us about prior. But I never actually took the time to consider that she was hurting deeply. In my mind, she had ended the relationship. She was feeling bad about it, as she should. I wasn't a soothing shoulder for her to cry on, and now, with hindsight, I get regret pangs when I think of how I wasn't there for her in those initial stages. In one instance, my brother, sister, and I came home from school to find that she was still at work. After a couple of hours passed, we grew hungry, and I called and asked her what we'd be having for dinner. "There's lots of food in the fridge. Fix something." "Ugh, fine," I obliged with much gratitude. The three of us decided we'd cook up some hamburgers. We made a whole big, messy activity of it. When my mother came home that evening, exhausted from the day, she barely stepped foot into the kitchen before we jokingly boasted, "We made our own hamburgers." My mother looked around the kitchen at the mess we had left behind. Then she paused and frowned at us and said, "You didn't make me any?" As my mother stood there, I realized this hadn't even occurred to any of us to do. What was wrong with us? "No, we..." I started. "Never mind." My mother shook her head angrily, rushing to her room. I exchanged glances with my brother and sister and braced myself to go to her bedroom and apologize. There, she sat on her bed, crying to herself, wiping her own tears. I hugged her tightly and apologized, coming to terms with the fact that she needed us just as much as we needed her. Several months later, my siblings and I grew accustomed to and even began to take advantage of the weekend visits with our father. We'd spend the night at his apartment, and then we'd wake up to McDonald's breakfast orders for us in the morning. After we happily wolfed down our meals on his television trays, he'd resurface with an offer for the day's plans. "Do y'all want to go to the bookstore?" We were always game. There were certain things my dad didn't bat an eye about spending his hard-earned money on for his children. Education, books, Senegal, and technology, in that order. "Hey, Dad, can I get money to go to the movies?" "No, you don't need it." "Hey, Dad, can we go to Senegal?" "Sure." We could always count on an unlimited budget for books, and we would spend at least an hour at the bookstore, each making our deliberate selections, sometimes reading them in the store before we purchased them, only to read them again. Then we'd go home, go to our separate corners, and disappear into our individual worlds. That was how we bonded. Whether out of guilt or his yearning for a new car, my dad left me with his 1997 Saturn. So when the provisional part of my license expired, my teen angst was freed and I was at liberty to visit my dad, my friends, and my new boyfriend. I chose the latter two far more often, but during one particular weekend, I decided I wanted to pay a visit to my younger cousin, Ida, and gossip about some boys in Senegal. She and her mother had just come in from Senegal and were staying with my father in his two-bedroom apartment. My father had always made it abundantly clear that we were always welcome in his home, so I didn't feel the need to announce my visit to him beforehand. I knocked on the door and Ida answered, surprised to see me. "Oh, hey, Joisa." "Hey, girl." I stood in the doorway and saw my dad sitting at the bar facing the kitchen where my Aunt Mamisa was cooking. Behind them in the back of the room, I saw a woman I didn't recognize standing near the balcony door, talking on the phone. She looked in my direction and then held the phone closely to her mouth, uttering the words, "Oh my God." Not in the frightened sense, but in the "shit is about to go down" sense. Then she walked out onto the balcony and continued her phone call. There was a look of knowingness in Ida's eyes that disturbed me, like she was searching me for recognition or understanding of some sort. This all happened within the span of 4 seconds, and it would take another couple of hours before I fully processed the scene before me. What struck me as immediately odd, however, was that my father, though pleasant, greeted me with, "Hey, you don't call?" His tone suggested a joke, but his stiff demeanor said the opposite. I looked to my aunt, who had the same searching eyes as my cousin. Something was going on. For the first time, I felt unwelcome in my own father's home. Pretending to laugh at my dad's rhetorical accusation, I remained standing in the doorway. I told him I had just come by to talk to Ida. My dad, most likely finally sensing how awkward I felt, waved his hand and said, "Come in." But it was too late. I already felt like unwanted company. I shook my head, smiling. "What did you want to talk to me about?" Ida asked me. To maintain airs, I told her, "It's gossip. I'll just call you and tell you later." "Are you sure?" she asked. "Yeah," I said as I backed away, looking one last time toward the balcony where the stranger whose presence eclipsed my comfort snuck glances. Then I said goodbye to everyone and left, my mind racing and replaying the moment the door opened over and over again. When I got home, my mother was undressing in her room. I knocked on her door. "Mom, are you busy?" "Just a second." I considered how I was going to present my findings to her. I didn't want to be wrong in my assumption that Dad had moved on so quickly, especially given her sensitive state. How would I tell her without hurting her feelings? But then I remembered she had been the one to end things, so maybe she wouldn't even bat an eye. Maybe she'd be happy for him. I was prepared to be if she was. Either way, I needed to know what I had just experienced. My mother slid her door open. "Yes, my sweetie? Can I talk to you?" I asked. My mother's smile grew uneasy. Given my tone and her reaction, I'm pretty certain she assumed I was going to tell her I was pregnant or had HIV, so maybe my actual news would come as a relief. I sat down on her bed and she sat next to me, expectant. "So I just came from Dad's." Her shoulders relaxed slightly, but not that much. "Yeah?" I told her every detail of the story, including my cousin and aunt's reactions and the strange woman's ominous, "Oh my God." I watched as my mother listened, taking my words in, processing them. Then I asked in a lighter tone, as though presenting her with what I was certain was an educated guess, a deduction at best. "Is Dad seeing someone new?" My mom took a second, looking at me, contemplating. It was my turn to search her eyes, looking for a revelation of some sort. But I was also relieved not to be the bearer of any bad news when she nodded and said, "Uh-huh." "Oh, she did know," I thought, exhaling, glad that was out of the way. As I revisited the scenario in my mind, something about the flashback and my mother's calm confirmation alarmed me. I could feel my heart pounding as the pieces started coming together. An overwhelming dread hit me and I gasped out loud. When I turned to my mother, she was already watching me, waiting. "Is that why?" My mother nodded solemnly before I could finish my question. It was as if she had transmitted her emotions to me. The tears came immediately. Instantly, as though even they had been waiting for me to figure it all out. A sound escaped my throat that I didn't recognize as I bent into my lap and covered my face. What? My dad? Was my father even capable of this? How? Why? I felt my mother's arms around me trying to hug the rock my body had become. "I'm so sorry. I'm sorry, sugar," she said softly. "Who is she?" I managed to stammer through tears. She shook her head. "She works at his office." "What? How long?" I had worked at his office for an entire summer when I was 14. Did I know her? Did she know me? How come I didn't recognize her face? My mother rubbed my back. "I still don't know. I've been trying to find out." "Do Amadou and Malik know?" "Yes," I told them. "But your father and I decided we didn't want you, Lamine, and Elise to have a bad image of him." I started thinking about the image I had of my father and the deception I felt. He didn't even deserve my sympathy. All that time I had been so concerned with him being alone, when my mother, my poor mother, I couldn't stop sobbing from the pain of the truth. I never would have imagined my peaceful, patient father could be capable of causing so much pain. I stopped going to his apartments on weekends altogether, making excuses that were purposefully flimsy enough to make a statement, but sturdy enough to not tip off my younger brother and sister. I couldn't make conversation with him. I stopped asking him for things. I didn't want anything from him. If he noticed my distance, he didn't acknowledge it, which made me even angrier. As far as my mother was concerned, my discovery had opened the floodgates of detail. As she pieced together the history of his affair, she learned how callous the woman he had chosen to involve himself with was. My mother had met her on very few occasions, but in every instance, she smiled in her face while her actions spit on the past of which my mother had once been so certain. I had never hated anyone as much as I did her. I had never hated anyone, period. I'm never one to be bitchy for no reason. I actually sympathize with the stepmother in The Parent Trap, the Haley Mills version, because I never thought the twins gave her a fair chance. And so, even after my discovery, I was prepared to give this other woman the benefit of the doubt. Maybe she didn't know. Maybe my father was a master deceiver and had been two-timing them both. Maybe she was remorseful but too in love to back out. Maybe there was a justification for all this hurt. But when I finally worked up the courage to ask my mother how and when she found out, I decided the other woman was undeserving of my empathy. My one-sided rift with my father continued through my freshman year, slowly subsiding by the winter of my sophomore year with my decision to temporarily stop out of Stanford and take filmmaking classes at the New York Film Academy in Los Angeles. My decision required convincing both my parents, but especially my father, who was paying my tuition and who was not convinced that I would return. Convinced I was serious about my education and that he could count on me to still finish in 4 years, he felt a bit more at ease with my choice. After that, I decided that my anger toward my father required far more energy than I was willing to expend. I had to find a way to move on, especially since once I moved to Los Angeles for film school, we'd be back in the same city for a while. We didn't speak about her, and I didn't bring her up again until my senior year, when I put on my fourth and final college production, a Motown adaptation of Grease. I invited all of my family living in Los Angeles up to see it, including my father. I heard through the family grapevine that my father was going to bring this woman up to my school to see my show. Aghast and indignant, I decided to write him a polite, respectful email expressing my discomfort with her presence and general existence, reiterating that I had wanted to invite only family. Then, at the end of the letter, I asked him outright not to bring her. In a move that defecated on my feelings, my father, in so many words, reminded me that he was a father and I was his daughter. He wouldn't take orders from me, and if she couldn't come, then, well, he was sorry, but neither could he. My nose crinkled with the tears that I refused to shed. I was shocked, and further convinced that this woman had him under an evil, rancid, vaginal spell. My mother was livid, and so were his sisters, who scolded him for his misguided allegiance. By the time of the show, my family arrived to support me without him. The morning of the show, Lamine handed me an envelope from my dad. Inside, there was a check for $500 with a note that read, "Good luck, love, Dad." I asked my brother to return it to him, which I honestly went back and forth about because, Lord knows, I was a broke-ass college student. He did eventually come up a month later for my graduation without her. With my older brothers, my mother's sister, and my grandparents present, I'd like to think he put more thought into it. As the years followed and I found myself in New York and then back in Los Angeles under my mother's roof, I started to visit my father more frequently, especially since a few things had evolved. One, he had moved into a house in Ladera Heights, and while his new whore would stay over occasionally, she still kept her mansion in the marina to herself. Also, my brother's studio was in my father's house, And you would find me there every Sunday shooting episodes of my second web series, Fly Guys Present the F Word, a comedic mockumentary starring my brother and his rap group's attempts to make it in Los Angeles. Despite my father's complaints about the occasional noise, I could tell he enjoyed having us in his house, particularly when Lamine, Elise, and I would be there together. By that time, the three of us were well aware of the extent of the cultural differences that had transpired between our parents. Lastly, in 2009, the summer I moved to L.A., my sister and I took another trip to Senegal to see my family and to have some Sene fun. During that trip, I realized it's nearly impossible to be in my father's home country, amongst his family, and not be appreciative of his existence. The respect people there have for him and for all that he's done for them is overwhelming. Repeated proclamations of, "Your father is such a great man," and the excitement with which, "Oh, you're the kids of Dr. Jope?" was uttered restored some of the pride I had in my father as a man. Finally, I had to come to terms with the fact that my father is not a bad person. He's just a flawed man. As the schedule for shooting Fly Guys became more consistent, and my dad started to grow more accustomed to seeing me on the weekends, and often during the week, he started to bring food home for me, sometimes calling in advance to ensure I was there, or leaving it in the fridge for me to come claim. As broke as I was during those times, it was always appreciated. On one of the evenings, our schedules aligned serendipitously, and we were able to eat together. I sat and ate at the kitchen bar, discussing international news with him while he watched MSNBC on the couch, when suddenly I had a bout of deja vu. Nothing dramatic, just a tingle and mild dizziness that reminded me I had been in that particular situation before. My deja vu is pretty useless. It doesn't provide any insight other than, "Oh, hey, you went through this at some point in the universe's spectrum of time. Don't know when or how or what this means, but just thought you should know." I came back from my 2-second zone out and casually muttered, "Deja vu." And that's when my dad nonchalantly decided to expose me to my potential powers. "Oh, you know that runs in our family." "What?" "Deja vu. It's our family gift. Your grandmother had it. Her grandmother has it. Some of your aunts have it. I had it, but I didn't want it." He took a bite out of his sandwich, the brie and cranberry dripping out onto his plate. I looked at him with the skepticism I always did when he joked about abnormal things. "You're joking, right?" "No. Ask your aunts. You could have it too if you want to." "How did you know you had it? What does it do?" "I just knew. One day when I was in school, my friend and I were walking at night down a steep hill. There was an alley at the bottom of the hill, which ends at the corner. I had deja vu and my friend asked, 'What's wrong with you?' And I said, 'Someone is going to come around that corner from the alley on their moped and they're going to fall.' My friend laughed and said, 'You're crazy.' A minute later, someone came on a moped, turned the corner fast and fell. My friend put his hand on his head and said, 'Oh my God.'" My dad laughed at the memory of his bewildered friend as I sat frozen, forehead bewildered. "So you don't have it anymore?" I asked. "No, I didn't want it. Some people know what to do with it. I didn't want to think about it." I thought about the famous line from Spider-Man when Uncle Ben tells Peter Parker, right before Peter indirectly causes his death, "With great power comes great responsibility." My dad didn't want to be held responsible. Little did he know back then that he would be held responsible, financially, for many of my family members in the future. For the sake of his bank account, he should have tapped into his deja vu to see that shit, or at least turn it on and off to see which decisions were worth making and which weren't. Who knows what direction life would have taken him? Recently, my dad has been trying to spend time with my younger sister and brother and me in the form of monthly lunches. He will usually send us an obscure text that says sushi or Korean barbecue out of the blue, and my sister Elise and I will coordinate to include my brother Lamine, who is often forgotten because he works at my dad's office every day and thus sees him all the time. These family lunches are a highlight for me, not only because of the laughter and inside jokes my siblings and I share, but also because they are an opportunity to get inside my father's mind. We learn something new at each session. Without our prying too deeply, he'll occasionally volunteer information to us. "I'm going to sell the property I have in Dakar," he said at one lunch, as he flipped a thin slab of raw beef onto the hot grill in front of us. Many times, the information that he offers reached us long ago, through my mother or other family members. But to hear it from him directly is always to hear a more toned-down, it-is-what-it-is version. One winter day, we were sitting at lunch, me, Elise, and my father, eating at Hillstone, even though it was his idea to go to a steakhouse, he ordered the trout. I had the book on my mind and decided to fact-check. "Dad, did you and Mom meet in Bordeaux, France, or in Senegal first?" My sister jumped in like we were playing Family Trivial Pursuit. "France, right? Even I know that." "Yes, it was Bordeaux," my dad answered, taking another bite of trout. "Okay, and then she went to Senegal?" I confirmed. "Yes, she didn't go to Senegal until later," he said with a nod. Then he stopped cutting and acknowledged something that had been bothering me for the 12 years since they broke up. "I guess we never really had a conversation about what happened, did we?" I froze. Fucking duh. Rapid-fire flashbacks of tears, unanswered questions, missed college performances, and pensive diary entries raced through my head. Was he really about to use his words and not only acknowledge the divorce, but talk to us about what happened? Just weeks earlier, I'd had brunch with Andinette, one of my childhood fellow nomad friends. Actually, my only nomad friend. It had been several years since we'd sat down and caught each other up on our respective lives. She was briefly in town from Tennessee, venting that she wanted to return to Los Angeles, but the thought of living with her mom again was enough to keep her hungry and uncomfortable in Tennessee. Her mom is Ethiopian, but actually grew up in Senegal with my aunts. We laughed about trying to have honest conversations with our respective African parents about our feelings. In a brief moment of sincerity, I revealed to her that I wish I could get inside my father's head, that I could talk to him about the divorce, about his choice in women, just to get a sense of where his head was. But I shrugged, noting that my Senegalese father would never be open to such candid conversation and prodding questions from his daughter. Andinette nodded with understanding. Now, as I sat before my dad, my heartbeat revealed the surprise that my face tried to hide as I feigned nonchalance and tried to keep my tone casually delicate so as not to lose the rare opportunity for a truth viewing. "So," I started, "what happened?" My dad explained, between long gazes at his food and our respective faces, that after Elise was born, during our last year in Senegal, he wanted to go back to Los Angeles, but my mother had no interest in returning there. They both agreed that he would try to make it work in Los Angeles, and she would take us to Maryland. "But whenever I would visit you all in Potomac, I felt out of place. Your mother had an established way of doing things, and I started feeling a sense of detachment." By the time we had arrived in Los Angeles to reunite with him, he explained, he didn't know us as well as our mom did, and whenever he would try to intervene in certain aspects of raising us, our mother would have already established the right way to do it, and that the distance definitely played a huge part in their unraveling. As he explained, he made no excuses, didn't fault our mother or ever speak ill of her. Hearing him talk about it and acknowledge what happened gave me a sense of closure and comfort in knowing that I could actually talk to him about it. About anything, really. My father is now remarried, settling in with his new wife. And though I find myself tiptoeing around her with forced politeness, I don't find myself as hesitant to get inside his head. When I'm ready to go down that road, I will. Today, with the Obamacare California deadline looming, my dad calls me to make sure I have health insurance. "Hey, Dad," I answer. "Sign up for California Care. Google it and tell your sister." I'm driving on Edgewood to a meeting in Hollywood. "Dad, I've been had insurance. I'm grown," I say playfully, laughing because my dad still doesn't know exactly what it is that I do. He's just grateful I'm not on his payroll anymore. He laughs heartily. "Oh, you're grown? How many bills am I paying again?" "Oops." "Oh, just kidding. I was just playing. I'm not grown, Dad," I relent as I realize he's still paying my phone bill. I'm on a family plan. And my car insurance, that shit's expensive. And up until that conversation, which must have served as a reminder for him, my car was still in his name. No less than a week later, he gave me the pink slip of ownership. Now all my tickets go directly to me. I realize I can get so caught up in my own feelings that I forget how much my dad still does for me without a single complaint. I neglect to consider how much he will continue to support me, no matter what I need, as long as he can. While I still haven't heard the words, "I love you," I realize I haven't said them to him either. We both have some feelings to catch up on, and I know I'm not beyond initiating them. Dating lessons and summer lust. The joke women, including those who marry into the family, haven't had a great history with men. I observed this only in the last few years when one of my favorite Senegalese aunts, whose chill demeanor and laid-back beauty I've always admired, married a man who was absolutely hideous in every way. His face looked like God said, I can't. I'm tired. Let me see what I can do with these leftovers. I don't ever call people ugly, and if his personality didn't match his appearance, then his looks wouldn't be an issue. But after meeting him, it was abundantly clear that she was settling for some kind of security. This was the aunt I was proud to say my high school boyfriend had a crush on. She was the aunt who I hoped to look like and be like when I grew up. 12 years prior, my aunt married a handsome Senegalese man who lived in the house across the street from our family home. We met him during one of our yearly visits, and he seemed to be well-favored among the aunties. My aunt gave birth to her first child while she was staying with us in Los Angeles. She was the most adorable little girl ever, and the first child whose birth I remember, whose diaper, singular because it only happened once, I remember changing, and who I happily cradled and put to sleep on several occasions. She was the daughter my aunt always wanted. Soon after the birth, my aunt's marriage ended. Long-distance relationships are already hard to make work, so a cross-continental relationship was bound for failure. At the time, I attributed the end of their marriage to that alone. Then I grew up, took a step back, and took stock of my dad and his 6 siblings. We already know my father's marital situation, and the other situationships on his side of the family didn't fare much better. Out of his 4 sisters, none of the marriages lasted for reasons that varied, from polygamy to adultery to fatal freak accident. As a footnote, polygamy is legal in Senegal, which is a predominantly Muslim country. Where the Diop men are concerned, i.e. my dad's brothers, the curse is transmitted by name to the women they marry. There may be a loophole in marrying a Diop and not taking on the last name, but I've been unable to find evidence in that just yet. No marriage is without its problems, but I think I can trace the curse back to my grandfather, who, with his infidelities, also extended our family beyond that which he created with my grandmother. Perhaps that's where the curse began? The Senegalese are no stranger to curses, spells, and jinxes. Perhaps in being unfaithful to my loyal grandmother, my grandfather unknowingly solidified the fate of his children to a life of cursed romances and marriages. Or maybe the French culture's casual embrace of flings coupled with Islam's encouragement of responsible polygamy plays into our curse. Maybe it's not that big of a deal, as one of my father's Senegalese friends once told my mother. It's our God-given right to have a mistress. Oh, well then. Between my family history, its cultural and religious affinity for infidelity, and the American divorce statistics, I've held firm to the belief that if I don't get married, that would be just fine. Marriage will never be a priority for me. Even now, as I hear about relationships ending around me and marriages failing, as opposed to passing, I suppose, and people deceiving one another, sometimes losing tons of money in the process, I think, what's the point of getting married? For one thing, marriage seems to have become a bit of a national joke. There are reality shows for gold diggers while televised bridezillas and messy infidelities get sky-high ratings. To think that amidst all the infidelity, Americans actually had the nerve to try to get all sanctimonious when the gay marriage debate surfaced? Shut up. My indifference to marriage doesn't mean I won't commit to someone. I'm in a relationship as I write this, one to which I've been committed for over 7 years. Though the path here has been anything but easy. Trouble started as early as high school, where people thought I was a lesbian because of the way I dressed. It didn't help that I didn't know that rainbows were an LGBT symbol and would frequently color all of my name tags with the colors of the rainbow. In college, things started to get a bit better. In time, a few guys asked me out, but negatively influenced by my parents' divorce, I went through a chronic cheating phase. For one thing, I don't want to feel too attached to any one person after witnessing my mother's feelings of betrayal and violation in light of my father's affair. In my mind, it was cheat or be cheated on, and I felt a sense of satisfaction knowing that I had beat my partner to the punch, whether he knew it or not. This way, if he decided to cheat, then I would be numb to it because I had done it first. It's a really juvenile way of thinking, an emotional escape route that would allow me to leave with just the clothes on my back when necessary. By my junior year of college, my prospects, if not my attitude, had started to improve. I came back to college a bit thinner and with a perfectly white, straight smile thanks to 5 years of braces. I noticed the change almost immediately. I started getting more attention from guys and started to seek it in a completely different way than I did during my desperate middle and high school years. I wasn't interested in a relationship. I just wanted sexual activity. Because I had stopped out of school the year prior, I missed out on the housing draw, and I learned over the summer that I would be in a one-room double with a stranger in the quiet study dorm. Nope, wasn't having that. So I told my dad that I wanted to live off campus, somehow convincing him that it would be significantly cheaper because he wouldn't have to pay for a meal plan, my two jobs would allow me to buy groceries, and I would be able to help him with the rent. I didn't, and he wouldn't have allowed it anyway. I found an apartment that was a 5-minute drive from campus and moved in early, elated. I felt an overwhelming sense of liberation as I held the keys in my hand. I didn't have any furniture to my name, and I didn't care. After a night on the carpeted floor, I woke up the next morning and headed to IKEA, equipped with my very first credit card. A Discover card with a limit of $1,000, the most I'd ever had in my account at one time. With my new apartment, my own car, and my very own credit card, I developed a new independence. I could do whatever I wanted. Barring being enrolled in college, I was a grown-ass woman, and I could do grown-ass woman things in the privacy of my grown-ass woman home. The 2 years I spent in that apartment were two of the best years of my life, in terms of my friendships, my creativity, my relationships, and my sense of identity. The first boyfriend to set foot in my man-eating apartment was George. We met while I was home during a weekend in Los Angeles. He was super attractive, with a smile with which I fell in lust. We went on a date to the movies, and our chemistry was palpable. He was genuinely sweet and adorably shy and spoke with one of those hybrid London-Nigerian accents. When I drove back up to Stanford, we talked every single day. He was going to school to study business and was intent on returning to Nigeria to become the president someday. I was impressed with his ambition. Then one day, he called me with embarrassment and anger. I got kicked out of school. What? What happened? I kicked this guy's ass for talking shit. I was silent on the other end. I had never been with a guy who had kicked anyone's ass before. While I was disappointed that he was expelled, the simple bitch in me was impressed. Hello? He asked. You kicked a guy's... What happened? He was just all in my face talking shit and asking for it. I lost my temper and now I have to figure out what to do. I wasn't terribly worried about him. There were countless schools in Los Angeles and surely he could enroll in a community college while he applied to a new school. Only a couple of days later, he called me with some more news. I'm gonna be a Marine.
Like a swimmer?
No, like the military. The Marine Corps. We had known each other only a month, but he'd managed to leave me speechless twice in 1 week. Why? I asked. Do you have a death wish? We were still in a war,
and in my mind, he would certainly be deployed to go fight. I'd been reading every day about suicide bombings and mass military rapes, and women and children being killed mercilessly. Why would anyone who had options want to voluntarily subject himself to that? I didn't see bravery, I saw stupidity. But George was determined. He wasn't asking my permission. He was just gauging how I felt about his decision. I hated it, but it didn't matter. Well, I saw a recruiter today, and if I'm accepted, I go to boot camp in 3 weeks. Why did he even call me? But the good news, he continued, is I can come spend the weekend with you before I go. My mind and loins raced. He would be the first gentleman visitor in my new place. I tried to play it cool while still being outraged that he would decide to embark upon this suicide mission without actually taking my feelings into consideration. Well, you'd better. He made plans to come up by Greyhound bus a few weeks later. Most of my friends had taken trips abroad, and so I had no one to call and get advice from except Suzanne, one of my high school best friends who attended UC Berkeley. She wasn't that experienced with gentlemen callers, so couldn't offer any advice beyond, have fun. I picked him up from the bus station, bumping Rashida's provocative Georgia Peach, just in case he needed some subliminal signals as to what was about to go down. In case that wasn't enough, I had lit smell-good candles all around my house to set the mood. I had fleeting thoughts of returning home, only to find my apartment engulfed in flames, with Gemma, my Fargo-accented landlord, gee-golling in horror. But when I pulled up to find him waiting at that bus stop, a single duffel bag in hand, smiling with contained excitement to see me, I didn't give a damn about any fires. I watched him walk to my window. He leaned his head in and smiled. You're not going to get out and give me a hug? I promptly swung my door open and hopped into his arms. Then we shared our very first kiss. When we got back in the car, I popped in a 50 Cent CD, his favorite rapper of all time, and we headed back to my place. George was my first relationship since my high school boyfriend, and now he was leaving me to go become a soldier. I'm pretty positive I cried after he left. We'd known each other for only a couple of months, and while his incessant back-to-back phone calls and hey texts would annoy me, I still missed him. A topic we frequently broached, and that George was often too eager to talk about, was Lila, his ex-girlfriend who still lived in London. I'm not the jealous type, but I'm the jealous type. Appearance-wise, I didn't feel threatened. Feelings-wise, I did. Lila was George's first love, and she dumped him. I'm always wary about guys who've been dumped by girls they loved, because it typically means they have unresolved feelings. George didn't hide the fact that he'd enjoyed the years they spent together, but he frequently insisted that he was completely over her. This didn't stop him from putting her in his top 8 on his MySpace page, however. The top 8 was like a public acknowledgement of one's clique, a blanket endorsement of the people with whom one associates heavily. Because she lived in London, however, I was willing to excuse this as a simple oversight on his part. When George graduated from boot camp, I was there. I made the trip to the San Diego base, excited to be reunited with him, fantasizing that he'd pick me up and carry me across the auditorium, as Richard Gere did to Deborah Winger in An Officer and a Gentleman. I think I was oblivious to the fact that my friend's absence had caused me to gain weight. Having no one to hang with left lots of time for quality snack time. So when we were finally reunited, George's first words to me were, "Damn, girl, you've been eating good." I think I can safely pinpoint that as the moment at which my insecurity about our relationship started. This was also the first time I met George's mother, his sisters, and his brother. They were all nice enough, but I felt inadequate. Partly because Lila had made such a positive impression on his family before I was in the picture, and mostly because I hadn't been faithful during George's 13-week stint in boot camp. Over the course of his absence, we exchanged letters, but I found that just wasn't enough for me. Plus, his enthusiasm to be a Marine and shoot guns and kill people wasn't exactly compatible with my liberal, nonviolent views. So when an opportunity knocked, I answered, justifying my infidelity by telling myself that he still had feelings for his ex-girlfriend anyway. Still, a part of me felt guilty. Until, that is, I returned home from his graduation, where I was only able to spend a brief couple of hours with him as he stayed behind with his family, who had come all the way from London. Back home, I logged onto MySpace a few days later. It was during a bout of bored curiosity, which is typically the mood in which, if you seek, you shall find, that I clicked on his ex's page. And there, for all the world to see, was a heartfelt wall message from George, addressing her as baby. I was angry, slightly hurt, but mostly livid about what I perceived to be public disrespect. Nobody really knew about our relationship, but how dare he? I called him and immediately ended our relationship. Over the next couple of weeks, he called me back to back, apologizing, begging for my forgiveness. I grew satisfied as my hurt feelings turned to general irritation. Plus, by that time, I had already moved on with Taz. Taz, ruggedly handsome and with brash confidence, would probably drive a girl with low self-esteem to suicide. Had I met him during my high school years, I would have either succumbed to his blunt aggression or tucked myself away, deciding that I was out of his league. However, he met me during a time when I felt my confidence rising. I'd started to feel more comfortable in my skin, as many college students tend to. Never mind that I knew absolutely nothing about life. I was amused by Taz's hot temper, which was cutely mismatched with a deep, raspy French accent. When he grew upset with a joke I made at his expense, he sounded like a peeved Pepe Le Pew. Taz was generally extremely closed off, more so than I was, which drew me to him. An heir to his father's prosperous textile business, he attended school in Pittsburgh and held a 4.0 GPA, despite English being his second language. Even with his academic obligations, he managed to talk to me on the phone at 3 a.m. Eastern time every other night. With each conversation, he'd let me in more and more, and we grew to appreciate each other's opposite senses of humor. Taz and I had a strong sexual attraction to each other, one I still can't explain. But to that end, our relationship was often volatile. He could make me irate in a way that I didn't know I could be, and vice versa. Though we were never officially an item, he was insanely jealous of my time, and I, too, wasn't unaffected by his love for women. When we were great, we were amazing. When we weren't, it was severe. All these factors, despite his dedication to seeing me as often as he could, made me decide internally to never pursue a serious relationship with him. Though we remained in touch throughout the school year, we would each pursue other love interests, much to his dismay. By the time summer rolled around, I decided not to go home to Los Angeles. I had an apartment and freedom, so why would I? I took a temporary volunteer gig in Menlo Park as an after-school workshop instructor in the arts for kids aged 12 to 17. The only thing I remember about those kids was that not one of them knew who Michael Jackson was, which made me wonder what kind of sad kids Menlo Park was raising. I met Oladipe at the grocery store during the summer where my best girlfriends, Megan and Akilah and I, took a vow to be open-minded to everything that came our way. We made this decision specifically to add peer pressure to the youngest member of our trio, Akilah, whose standards for men were ridiculously high, undoubtedly based on her virginal status. So we made a pact to resist the inclination to say no. Every time one of us would consider backing out, we'd simultaneously guilt-trip one another by trailing off the refrain, "I mean, we did say." So that summer afternoon, when he approached me in the aisle of Safeway, nearly 2 inches shorter than me, with a colonial English and South African hybrid accent, I shrugged and said, "I mean, we did say." But Oladipe was just too much. He wanted to be romantic far too quickly, and not even in the sexual sense, which would have made me have a bit more respect for him, but in an emotional way that absolutely grossed me out. After going out on one date with him, I realized that he took himself and his feelings far too seriously. This was evidenced by the verses of poetry he texted me the same day we met. Ew. I don't even remember what we did on our first date, honestly, My memory is quick to efface and shield me from the irrelevant. Before I'm subject to harsh judgment, I'd like to assert that my callousness can't be attributed to nice guy unappreciation. He wasn't a nice guy in the sweet, gentlemanly sense. He was overbearing in his attempts to suck me into his fog of emotions. I've dated and politely turned down nice guys before and felt super bad about it. This was not one of those times. I do remember that we hung out close to Stanford's campus, and at the end of the night, we found ourselves near the posh plaza adjacent to Embarcadero Road, one of Palo Alto's main streets. I recall this part of the day only because it was then that he kept trying to hold my hand. Listen, I'll let you stick your tongue in my mouth before I let you hold my hand. It's mostly because of my own insecurities. The condensation that can brew between the heated concave part of the hands that touch is enough to drive me insane. Also, I have big hands with long, skinny fingers, and whenever I have to hold hands with people, in prayer or to help them safely cross the street, I'm worried that they will A, comment on the size of my hands, a la, damn, you got some big-ass hands for a woman, or B, remark how disgustingly sweaty my palms are as they pull theirs away. Or worse, not say anything at all and just endure my sweaty hands, hoping I don't notice them abruptly wipe their own hands immediately after we disengage. But in this particular instance, because my empathy gland is oversized and it pains me to be the cause of hurt feelings and rejection, I briefly obliged his third attempt to lock my hand to his. If only I had the visual defense mechanism that porcupines do. If only my hands were equipped with quills to defend me from the fingertip rubs he inflicted on the lines of my palms. Are you trying to predict my future mid-stroll, motherfucker? I thought, furious with myself for my genetic failings. I couldn't take it anymore. I made up a reason I needed to go home, and fortunately he obliged and drove me back to my apartment. No later than 2 minutes after I had barricaded my door behind me, heaving with the relief of freedom, I received a phone call. Worried that he would come back if I didn't answer, I picked up. Hello?
Look at the moon.
I paused. What?
Look at the moon, he whispered tenderly.
What about it? I asked, tapping my fingers with impatience.
Are you looking at it? He prodded.
I am. I was not.
I'm looking at it too. I just wanted you to know that. So you'll think of me and know that I'm thinking of you whenever you look at the night sky.
I felt my vagina dry and shrivel up, like a raisin in the sun.
Uh-huh,
I managed, incredulous.
Good night, he cooed.
Then he slowly and softly traced every button on his phone before he hung up. Probably. After days of curt responses to his texts and avoiding his phone calls, I wrote him a carefully crafted text telling him I wasn't looking for a serious relationship. He called me and told me it was my loss. Oladipo made me realize how much I hate overly sentimental gestures, especially if they're from the wrong guy. The final month of summer, my friends and I got into work mode, making sure we'd be set up financially for the impending school year. Megan was working at a law firm, making connections to secure an opportunity the following year. Akila, who worked at a tutoring program, was helping middle school kids get ready for their upcoming school year. I had gotten another job, my dream job, a position I've always wanted since I was 9 years old. Ever since my little brother, Lamin, and I simulated owning a fast food restaurant called Hamburgers Everywhere, I've had ambitions of owning a restaurant or being a waitress. 9-year-old me clearly thought the two were interchangeable. When I got a job as a waitress at the new Counter Burger restaurant in Palo Alto, I got to see a restaurant built and managed from the ground up and learned that my stress levels would be more fit for waitressing. Aside from some shitty managers and a couple of horrible co-workers, I love waitressing. Even today, I maintain that if nothing works out in my life, I would be content working as a waitress. I met Martin while serving tables during one of our busy lunch shifts. He wasn't in my section, but I kept passing by his table, making sure he had everything he needed. He smiled politely and shook his head. After the third attempt with no word exchanged between us, I shrugged. Well, I tried. And just as he was getting up to leave, he spoke. In a heavy French accent, he asked me my name. Tu parles français? I tried. He told me he was from France by way of Martinique and was in the country for a stage, or a paid internship, working for a food service supply company. Yep, he could get it. We exchanged numbers and I marveled at my luck. What were the odds of my meeting another cute French guy? At the very least, I'd have a new opportunity to practice the language. Martin and I kept it casual, going on a couple of dates here and there. I was still talking to Taz from Pittsburgh by way of France every night when he decided to make another trip to see me in Palo Alto. By this time, we had switched to our third manager at the counter, a man who started off nice enough, but then transformed into a merciless tyrant in an attempt to assert his power. Taz's visit meant I had to ask for time off during the weekend, our busiest time, because I knew the manager would never approve of me taking days off because a friend was in town. I decided to lie about my circumstances. In a prophetic lie I'd come to regret for the rest of my life, I told him I had to go help my aunt in Oakland, who was sick. In any case, it worked, and Taz and I spent the entire weekend together, acting like a couple and fighting like one. While we had a great, fiery chemistry, that weekend only solidified for me that I could not be in a relationship with him. Consequently, I never allowed my feelings for Taz to develop simply because when I pictured our future, I saw a vulnerable me. Call me a coward, but that just wouldn't do. Taz made me realize what I don't want in a relationship. I don't ever want to be at the mercy of my emotions. That's fun and adventurous for some people, but not me. When Martin asked me to be his girlfriend, I accepted. Taz flipped out when I told him, frustrated that I wouldn't give us a chance. I told him I didn't trust him enough to be in a committed relationship with him, and he stopped talking to me for over 6 months. In the meantime, I got to know Martin more. We spoke only in French, and he was one of the most affectionate guys I'd ever been with, which he could sense. Prior to making our relationship official, we were friends with benefits, or so I thought. One night, he called me to ask if he could come over and hang out. I told him I was on my period. He got silent and asked, "What does that have to do with anything?" Embarrassed, I said, "Oh, I just thought you should know. But come anyway." When he came, we sat on my bed watching movies and he asked me again, "Why did you tell me you were on your period?" Truthfully, it was because I expected our quality time to be centered only around sex. I told him otherwise. "Just in case I was moody, I didn't want you to be offended." He nodded, and I thought he bought it. But he didn't. One day, a couple of weeks later, he asked me if he could come over and talk. I had no idea what he wanted to talk to me about. That evening, he walked in the door, looking more somber than I'd ever seen him. "I don't think you like me very much," he started. "What? What are you talking about?" I asked. "Oftentimes, I will call you and you won't call me back. Or when I come over to spend time with you, you'll just go to sleep. And then that period thing. What are we doing?" As I listened to him go on and on about what he wasn't getting from me in our relationship, I grew confused. What was this? I opted for the truth. "Honestly, I thought we were just..." Shit. What were the French words for friends with benefits? "What did you think we were just?" he insisted. I scrambled to put words together without sounding vulgar. It was the first language barrier issue we'd encountered. I kept repeating the words in English, hoping he'd understand what benefits meant, but the more and more I said it, the dumber I felt. Frustrated, he proposed a solution. "I think we should stop seeing each other, since you don't like me." I was shocked. I had never been broken up with before, much less from someone with whom I didn't even know I was in a relationship. But if this was what he wanted, then who was I to stop him? Not his girlfriend, apparently. I nodded. "If that's what you think is best." As I walked him to the door, I found myself starting to get emotional. It had been 2 months of seeing each other after all, and the thought of not seeing him or spending any time with him actually made me sad. As I opened the door for him, he turned around to hug me, but stopped when he saw tears in my eyes. "Are you actually sad?" "I don't know, maybe." This sign of emotion was apparently enough for him to reconsider his decision. He kissed me, picked me up off the floor like I weighed 30 pounds, and we made up. An hour later, Martin asked me one more time to explain what a friend with benefits was. When I did, he told me, "We don't do that in France." Then he asked me to be his girlfriend. As our relationship progressed and Martin and I started practically living together, he introduced the topic of meeting my friends. "Why haven't you introduced me to your friends? Are you ashamed of me?" I laughed. "Of course not. I hadn't really thought about it." But the truth was, I had. My friends were pressing me about meeting him, calling him my secret lover. The problem was, Martin had this cornrow braid combo situation going on that I hated. It was 2006, and men with braids after the age of 21 were either thugs or painfully out of touch. I didn't want to tell him to cut it, because I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I didn't want to appear shallow, but I had never introduced a boyfriend to my college friends before, and I wanted the presentation to be perfect. The day he casually mentioned that he felt like cutting all his hair off, my enthusiasm was on 11. "Yes, absolutely. Try something new. Go for it." As soon as he unveiled his new look, a freshly cut fade with a neatly trimmed 5 o'clock shadow, I was in love. Was I that superficial? I guess. His haircut timing happened to coincide with the winter comedy event, thrown by Megan's sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha. This would be the perfect opportunity to unveil him to my friends. I invited him out, waiting a few days so as not to seem obvious about my sudden interest in showing him off. "Hey, do you want to go to this comedy show? You can meet my friends." He smiled, seeing right through me. So it was the hair. The comedy show was a great time, and my friends approved of him. I was so relieved to have that out of the way. Martin and I were getting closer, but his internship deadline, which had already been extended, was rapidly approaching. This meant he'd be going back to France, relegating our closeness to long distance. While my feelings for him were strong, this fact was hovering over my heart and my head. I started wondering if I was really ready to try to make it work with him while he was so far away. I was only 21, and after many awkward years, I was just starting to enjoy guys being into me. Plus, Martin had a trait that drove me nuts. He loved to argue, in an often condescending manner. At 25, he was 4 years older than me, though he acted as if it were more like 10. Like many people, I don't like being told what to do, nor do I like to be made to feel inferior under any circumstances. In one particular incident, I had just started to gear up for Stan Funk, a show put on during homecoming weekend for alumni and undergraduates alike. I had been asked to direct the show and was honored to be a part of it. Martin had decided to drop me off at rehearsals that night, as he was planning on spending the night. We were early, so we parked in front of the rehearsal space. I had to get some paperwork ready and started filling it out in the car, but the pen I was using had no ink, so I threw it out the window. Martin turned to me from the driver's seat. "Go pick that up." Maybe it was his tone or his stern look or the imperative "va" in French that triggered my anger, but I snapped. My anger at all the times he talked down to me had accumulated, and it burst forth at once. He was going to hear all my grievances in his car that night, very loudly. His eyes widened in surprise when I started, and when I was done, he sat silently, looking ahead. As I calmed down, my anger slowly subsiding, I started to think about his command and my response. Had he simply said, "Come on, don't do that," in a tone that appealed to my typical environmental sensitivity, things would have been fine. But there was an edge to his demand, and the way that he condescended to me that I knew I could never tolerate. Despite that, I regretted my temper and my harsh words, and when I got out of the car to go to rehearsal, I picked up the pen. When I handed him the pen through his open window, he turned his face to me and said, "I would have had more respect for you if you just left it there." Really, asshole? While his words gut-punched my ego, I retorted, I didn't do it for you. Still, my relationship escape route was clearly etched in my mind from that day forward. I had one for every relationship, influenced negatively by my parents' divorce. So, when my cousin Ida called me one day,